Before we begin on the Tower of Babel story, which is a very interesting story, it's only 9 verses, but it's kind of packed, we might just review it just a bit. There are 2 types of materials in Genesis 1 to 11. Genealogies, and we've gotten a bit of genealogies. We didn't go through all of them, and thank goodness maybe we didn't. And then there are narratives, and stories, and that's like the one we'll take today. These narratives can either be creation narratives. We have that in Genesis 1 and chapter 2 also. Or they can be what I call crime and punishment narratives. You know the title of Dostoevsky's famous novel, Crime and Punishment. And that's really a nice way to look at them in general. The one that we had in the Garden of Eden told of the crime of trying to... What was wrong? What did they do that was wrong?
Disobeyed
and tried to do what? To be like God, yes. And to have... To know everything in that sense. They had to drink the bitter medicine by God's ordinance of knowing that they would also die and that they're limited. They can't be like God, you see that. That's really what happens in all these stories. It isn't that God punishes them. That's really not right. God helps them by keeping them human. Because otherwise they would do what? They would have a nail on their head and they would no longer be human. They're inhuman. That's really the story of Cain and Abel. They're the crime that was done because of perception of injustice was what? What do you do when you're disadvantaged and you suffer injustices? Cain fell. You turn to violence, isn't it? But God doesn't want his history being red with blood. So what does God do? Rather surprising. What's the punishment in that case when humans do that? Yes, well, first he drove them out. Remember that? You can't have that happening in society. And then when murderers want to come and take blunt vengeance even on the criminal, then God even marks them. So there's justice even for the criminal. Not only for the oppressed, but for the oppressor. That's rather interesting. We did not take up the next crime and punishment story that's in this series, and that is the first 4 verses of chapter 6. The sons of the gods and the giants. There the crime is that they want to be super people, a super race. Remember the sons of the gods saw the daughters of men, that they were fair and went in unto them. And then what came out? What were born? The giants, remember that? But God stopped that. That's another possibility of human delinquency. God's puts their ages, the normal human age, and limits them. We didn't take the flood. That would have taken a long time. I was just talking with someone about that coming down here. And I said, it's the longest story in all of Genesis 1 to 11. And it's possible to take it in one period. Maybe we did 2 and 3. This had been a little bigger, but what's the crime there? I think you all know that. What's the crime that causes the deluge? Well, sin, all right. Anyone? God doesn't say sin. They've always been delinquent and sinful all the way through. But which particular, what was the particular crime that made the Lord say, I'm sorry I made humans on the earth because what have they done with the earth? They have corrupted it. He never says that he's sorry that he made birds and whales and slugs and all those things. But he does say, sorry he made us. Because what? We're capable of filling the world with violence, outrage. That's what it, what is used, the word that's used there, chomosh in Hebrew. And the punishment is, well, it's a twofold one. It really isn't a punishment. On the one hand, he stops all that, and the world almost goes back to the chaos from the beginning, doesn't it? Except what's floating now on the surface of the chaotic waters. A little ark with all of creation in it. So he does preserve his creation. And at the end, he guarantees, with a rainbow, ladies and gentlemen, as the sign of his covenant, that there will always be a place for humankind until the end. There will be an end of the creation, but until that time, he guarantees. It's very interesting. And we still live under the rainbow. We just alluded to the crime and punishment of Noah and his sons. The sin was not Noah's drunkenness, although that certainly was a shameful sort of thing when he was weak and exposed. What was the crime in that story? We're just kind of running through these stories because they're the famous stories. That one people don't know so well, maybe just as well. What was the crime in that story? Yes, one of the brothers, when he should have helped his helpless father, made fun of him, isn't it? Yes. And that can happen too in society, that the younger generation doesn't want to receive the traditions and the wisdom of the older generations. And then what was the punishment? It was a curse at this time that they became a slave of the brothers. The brothers enslave one another when you don't have that sort of good order. So God doesn't let people get by with it. I guess he's trying to keep us human. Well, let's go now to Genesis chapter 11. 9 verses, and I think what we'll do is just read the whole thing right straight through. And as you read it, I'd like to ask you to find for yourself, and we'll discuss that a bit, what do you think is the center of gravity, the most important section, climax, if you will, or whatever you want to call it. What do you think is the most important? There are many important things here. But what do you think is the most important? Would you read just verse 1 first?
Now the whole earth had one language and a few words.
All right, and the next 3 verses. 3-4. Mm-hmm, because it tells what people are doing.
And as men migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar.
One more verse.
Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in heaven, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth."
So that's what the united humanity does. Now how about verses 5, 6, 7, and 8? Would you read that next part, please?
And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what we will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them."
Keep on. 2 more verses.
"Come, let us go down with them, and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech."
And one more verse.
"So the Lord scattered them abroad, from there over all face of all the earth, and they left off building the city."
And now the conclusion, would you read the last one, please? Next person? Yes. Verse 9.
His name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth.
All right, and I suppose now, as usual, we have certain parts that we think are key. I call them centers of gravity. Anyone want to volunteer? What strikes you? What do you think is kind of the key to the whole business, the most important statement? The Lord came down. Okay, that's a good candidate. That he has to see what they're doing, isn't it? They're building up, and what does he do? He comes down. And they said, "Come, come, let us. And the Lord says, "Come, let us go down," isn't it? He's kind of mocking them. So, okay, I think that's a good one. But there are other candidates too. All right, we want to make a name for ourselves. Just talk about that. Is it good to have a memorial for yourself? Don't you want to have a tombstone? No, you don't. Oh, you're very humble. I want all my accomplishments on it too. I'm teasing a bit.
Just 1 second, sir. "And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them." And the Lord, if nothing's impossible for them, then they are like a god again. You can do anything, and he doesn't want that.
All right. He said, here, they're all still united. One language, one city, one united people. And this is only the beginning of what they're doing. If they succeed in this, nothing will be kept from them. Let's ask about that too. The first thing about a name, is it wrong for people to have a memorial or a monument to themselves?
I don't think it's wrong necessarily.
Not necessarily, I think that's right. In the Bible, sometimes this expression is used of the Lord, making a name for himself. Well, that we understand. Sometimes it's used, for instance, in the story in 2 Samuel of Absalom, during the time when he was successful in his rebellion, put up a monument in Jerusalem because he didn't have any offspring, so that he might make a name for himself. You see that? And there's nothing said about good or bad. He was kind of a bad guy after a while, but you can have a monument. And I suppose that in itself is not wrong. Well, let's go at two more things. You mentioned one. What's really their crime here? What is really wrong? If it's not necessarily wrong to have a memorial, you know, to go to the moon, or to set up a memorial for this is what we did. We built this church, and we put this was the committee that planned it. And this is the architect, and so forth. We built this bridge.
Seattle has made a name for itself. We have the tallest building west of the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Very proud of it, too.
Very proud, and made a name for itself. And there's nothing wrong with it. Okay.
Well, what's wrong with unity? Jesus prayed for unity, and that's something it seems that we're all trying to work for now. It has supposedly a good, that God wants is unity, and here, when they're wanting to be united, why God scatters them?
And aren't there some projects that you must be united on? How would we have ever gotten to the moon unless we had really gotten our resources together? We can't possibly, you know, finance and get those things.
Could our God be a jealous God, and he's getting jealous of these united people because they're doing the impossible?
It could be. That's what the serpent said in chapter 3. He knows that if you eat, you'll be like him. I think it's more than jealousy, though. I think that there's also loving concern that he really would like to keep us what we are, rather than let us become inhuman. Someone else is coming.
I'm not sure they're building it for the right reason. Mm-hmm. It says, they're building it for the right reason, but they say God wants us to make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole.
Okay, now you're bringing a new aspect out that nobody so far has mentioned. We don't want to be scattered abroad. We'd like to have. Some people even say he's also talking to the archangels, Uriel and Michael and Gabriel and all the rest of them, you know. Let's go down. By the way, what he does actually in when he intervenes in this enterprise is not described, except that it changes their language, you see that. One of my old professors said, after the change of languages, they wanted to have some more bricks, and what the guys did, they misunderstood it, and they sent up bananas. And you know, find it then it doesn't work. But wait a second though, didn't we have last time that God blessed that teeny family of Noah, and they increased and they spread out all over the world, didn't they? Especially to the extremes. And you had the sons of Japheth, of Ham, and of Shem, according to what? Their languages, wasn't it? Different languages is God's blessing. And different, what was it? Lands, geographical places, different political setups, and different families, physiognomy, you know, our race. And so in that sense, it seemed to be good. Well, now let me ask you this question about verse 1. Now, let's go back through verse 1. We have a number of things lined up here, and I'm not going to take a vote which candidate is right, because I'm quite sure everyone can contribute to this, and it will come out, except one candidate, my favorite one, has not been mentioned, and I'll mention it as we come along. I'm just teasing you a little. It's been mentioned a bit, but not really. Let me ask, if we go back to verse 1, was there ever a time that we can nail down, I mean a test with evidence, when all nations had one language And then all of a sudden there was a change, and then there were many languages. Pardon? Oh, in the New Testament. Uh-huh. There, I think we have the opposite. It starts with the many languages and then speaking about the one thing of the gospel, the wonderful deeds of God in their languages. You see that? No, I like that. And that's a real, we'll put that way in the back of our heads here as Christians for and a very important thing for its ultimate. But I'm going back to ancient history. Well, the way I was taught, I think we talked about this last time, if the world was created in 4004 or something like that, during Usher's chronology, then at the time of Peleg, do you remember we had him in the genealogy last time, and I told you when I read it, it was in split, and there's a little note that simply said, in his time, the nations were divided, you see that? Then Bishop Usher, at least, and that's kind of the main one that people have been following, was 2246 BC, the nations first had one language, and then all of a sudden it changed from then, and now they have many languages. And by the way, many people have taken that as pragmatic fact. I remember visiting in a hospital in Moorby, South Dakota once. I wasn't a member of my own congregation, but he was German-Russian, so I had to visit him too. and I visited him, and you know, he was telling about how in Russia, in Ukraine, at least they got the Bible stories. And they knew what the world was about. And they knew all the languages and all these things. And he was referring to this, you see that? It was not my purpose nor interest at that time to straighten him out on his ethnology and his ancient history. On the other hand, hasn't this, ladies and gentlemen, now we're really coming to the end, of course, we have to mention, hasn't this been kind of the way humankind in Western civilizations understood it through creation, fall, flood, Tower of Babel? Maybe we can forget most about the other little things, you know? It's just been the human way of thinking. That's why when we hear these stories, we immediately say they apply to us. Do you see that? They make sense to us. They would not make sense to someone coming from a non-Western culture. Do you see that? Our culture has been so imbued with all these stories in our thinking for a long, long time that we've been influenced through the Judeo-Christian tradition, that this is what is part of it. Now, I guess I would have to say that when a story starts like this, once upon a time, there was unity in the world. Well, you know, once when a story starts that, Wayahi in Hebrew, once upon a time, you know that's perhaps a little different than another story, isn't it? And I put on the board here, just to show you the structure, that here you have, got something here, you have the whole earth is united, verse 1, and at the end, the whole earth is divided. I think that this is a elemental question. I grew up in northern Wisconsin in the 20s and 30s, and that was a united culture. Even though the little village, Black Creek, Wisconsin, was, I think we had two main churches, Lutheran and Catholic. There was a small little Methodist church. But the people were pretty well ethnic Germans, you know. And our school system didn't have a diversity of viewpoints. Teacher number one taught the same thing as teacher number two. And religiously, I think the priests and the pastors taught the same thing. I think politically, even though they would be have a few Democrats, mostly Republicans, they weren't that far apart. There was the Depression. I can still remember that. Saturday night, some of these candidates for office would come in and stand on the back of trucks and talk about liberal ideas, but that was only under the pressure of the Great Depression. That I can remember that. But it was a unified thing. Then, of course, what happens, and I think many of us grew up in such communities, you see that? It was unified. Get that in? Then you come outside and you live in another culture and you see other things, and what do you notice when you live somewhere else? Yes, difference, and also
similarity.
Say, even if you went to a non-Western culture, you know what I mean? You'd notice both difference and similarity. And then you ask yourself, you know, why, see? Well, this is, I think, what the story at the beginning says. God's will is really that there should be communication. And not these, someone called them barriers. But Why do we have the barriers? And the answer is, in this enterprise that we've been describing here, that humans not only were engaged in, but are engaged in it. What is that? Is it just only what has been the candidates so far? And I'm not against these candidates. We don't want to have everything split up, because if we split up and dissipate our efforts, nothing will come of them. So what do? We're united, see? We make inventions. Was it wrong for them to make an invention here? No, they came into the flat land of Shinar, and to get any buildings there, you would have to be a in a place like this, but what do?
They have
a breakthrough, isn't it? A technological breakthrough. Do you think that in itself was wrong? It also says here, as men migrated from the east, and they lived there, they settled there. Is that wrong? No. And you have an increase of population. I don't think that's wrong. Or to make that pliable substance, bricks, and they have bitumen. Is it wrong for them to make a city?
No, that's enterprise.
Mm-hmm. And is it wrong to make a monumental city? Make a name for ourselves.
Maybe they paid to God.
Depends upon your motive.
Depends on your motive.
Mm-hmm. If you do it to glorify yourself, mm-hmm. you attract from God, then it's wrong.
All right. Maybe we're and then you mentioned this thing that we don't want to be scattered abroad. They're supposed to spread out all over. And here they seem to not want to do that. I think the idea is that if they're scattered abroad, they can't produce what they want. You see that? Well, let's take a few modern examples of it. I think space age is a big thing right now, isn't it? How have people looked at the space age enterprise? Has everybody been happy with it?
No.
Father of the space age, Dr. Goddard, really ridiculed out of this country, so I went to Germany and gave us plans to Germany.
Uh-huh. And, let's say even our going to the moon, which is, you know, our accomplishment. The Russians had said, listen what they said when they put up the first Sputnik. Some Soviet spokesman said, this is a moon that was not made by the God of the Old Testament. What did he mean by that?
It's an object from his country.
That's right. If you people want to be so foolish as to believe there is a creator who makes moons and so forth, we have made our own, isn't it? And that's kind of what you were saying over here, that nothing will be withheld from us. You see that? Go for broke. But let's not just jump on the Soviets. And they have that sort of worldview, you see that? And it's what powers them.
Like with technology, nothing wrong with technology, we said, mm-hmm. but if you make technology your God, then it becomes evil.
Precisely. Mm-hmm.
Any kind of a creation man makes, he begins to worship it.
Yes, I can give you the exact words which are used here. Nothing will be withheld from them that they won't do. The same Hebrew expression occurs in the book of Job, chapter 42, verse 2. When Job finally says of God, I know that you can do all things. And to say that of humans, that they are able to do all things. In a way, it's right. We are emancipated. Isn't that the price we pay for having consciousness and doing what we want to do? That's the price. And so this is a very deep story. We wouldn't be human if we didn't. But don't forget that our people say the same thing. Neil, I asked Armstrong when he was really kind of a nice, we don't hear much about him, do we? Where is he? What does he do? Everybody else makes hay off of their things, but that guy seems to be sensible. What did he say when he stepped off? This is a small step for a man, but a giant step for mankind. Yeah. But what did President Nixon say? And I'm not jumping on Nixon, though. I never voted for him. And I was sort of kind of angry for those people who did vote for him and then left him in the lurch. What did he say when... Remember, he went way out in the Pacific to meet those guys. Remember that? And then they had a news conference, as usual. And remember what he said? The greatest week in the history of the world. And my good mother... Remember, I quoted her twice already in this class. I was right there. She caught that right off the bat, and she had always voted for Nixon. And she wasn't a super pious person at all, but she had. She said, "No, Holy Week is still the biggest." That was her comment. Holy Week, yeah, that's right. Good for her. I mean, absolutely. You know, we can get the we just jump on what the comes. You see that? But we don't, when someone from our own culture does it, then we don't notice what's happening. So I think we can say it. But I would like to present one more candidate here for what the crime is here, and that this is to be a tower that is having its top in the heavens. Now, that doesn't exclude the other topics that have been mentioned here, you see that. Making a big name for yourself and not wanting to be dispersed and all of this, but it's come closer to the one that you were referring to, that somehow, now I don't think that the Hebrews had this idea that they could climb into heaven. There are some people in preliterate societies, this is Eliade and other history of religion, comparative religion people have attested this, especially in Africa, where people would make towers that would climb into heaven, you see that? I don't think they're thinking, but the idea is that heaven is the transcendent place of God. And when it's called here a tower that's in the heavens, that's really what this is, this top is in the heavens, that I think that is where at least I would like to kind of put the emphasis. If I, you know, had to preach from the gospel, I'd do that. And I'd also do with at the end of my sermon what you did with Pentecost, you see that? But let's stay with the old story here. Before Abram, you see that, before there are Jews and before there are Christians, and then let it tell us all that it wants to tell us before we short-circuit it with Christians. Not that really that's short-circuiting it, but that's a different way of doing it. I guess I would like to point this out, that maybe you can see this. This is an odd way to tell a story. Instead of having, like we have the wonderful stories in chapters 2 and 3, where you've got the give and take, the woman, the serpent, the Lord, the man, and all this give and take. The only conversations you have here are kind of soliloquies. Humanity, all united effort, says, come to, let's make bricks. First they come to Shinar, then they decision to undertake this project, and then the actual undertaking is missing. That's why I put this in parentheses. And that's what I call humanity's heavenward enterprise. They're trying to go up toward heaven, isn't it? And then the next part, and it's just like a little, if you take a snapshot, it's not really telling the story completely. God comes, and so the Lord saw the city and the tower that the sons of men were making, and then he says, come, let us look at it. And he's got to look down. But it might seem as if there's a bit of humor here, but I think I agree with you over here that this is deadly certain, deadly serious. Do you see that? This is what's happening to mankind. So he comes to inspect it, just like humans had come to settle there, same word, and God decides to halt it, uses the same word. They said, come, let us. He says, come, let us. And it doesn't say that he knocked down the thing. How they built this thing, does any of you know, I have a slide at PLU when I teach this sort of thing, of an ancient, well, not an ancient, it's a Renaissance painting by, some of you may have seen it, what's the fellow's name? Bruegel the Elder, Pieter Bruegel the Elder, of the building of the Tower of Babel. And they have all kinds of derricks and people are coming. It's a very interesting thing. It's kind of a Renaissance picture. And I suppose modern artists, I don't have a collection of that, can make the same sort of thing, you see that? It's not described, that isn't described, it's rather surprising. I suppose the author was so interested in his other purposes, he just didn't describe that. And even the only thing that we have here of God's intervention that's described here is changing their tongues, you see that? And then all it says that after their tongues were... their languages were changed, they left off. Oh, no, it does say, verse 8, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. They left off building the city. And then there's a kind of a joke here when it says, the name of that city is called Babel. What does that mean?
To ramble on.
Yeah. Confusion. So it should have been the united capital of united mankind, isn't it? Of humankind. And I think they were thinking of the word Babylon. This is kind of a jab at the big nation of Babylon. You see, where Nebuchadnezzar came, you know, the boogeyman who carried them into exile and destroyed the temple and all this and that. And they did have a big tower in Babylon. It was called Esangila. And it was a kind of a sacred hill with, by the way, 7 stages, each one of them colored and according to the signs of the planets. And on the top of it was a temple where the king, priest, and the queen, priestess, came together in the sacred marriage and renewed all the fertility of the land. And this was a name. The Israelites don't go into that except through the name. The word Babel in Akkadian seems to mean the gate of God. But in Hebrew, you have a folk etymology, it means confusion. So that's what the last thing is here. They're simply making fun of it and saying, well, that's an instance where a nation, Nebuchadnezzar, wanted to make his empire the lasting empire that would be totalitarian, cover everything. And here, God has knocked that off. And I guess there were some ziggurats, we call those temple towers over in Mesopotamia, that just weren't completed. Maybe that's what they're referring to. But the end of the story simply is this. Its name was called Babel because there the Lord confused the languages of all the earth. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of all the earth. Well, let's stop here for a moment for any comments, questions. We have quite a bit of time here, which is nice.
I'd like to ask a question, and it may not be an important one, but in verse 5, it says, "And the Lord came down to see the city and tower which the sons of men had built." This implies that it was completed.
Yes.
To this point, it didn't say whether anybody was coming down with the Lord, but suddenly, in 6, the Lord is speaking. He said, "Behold, there are one people," so on and so forth. And then...
It's a soliloquy.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he is
okay.
Talking with himself,
okay,
and making up his mind, deciding what
okay.
to do. And then he does it.
All right.
But you are pointing out something that is rather interesting in this. I mentioned before that what you have here in this story is not as genuine a narrative as we have in 2 and 3. In a genuine narrative, you have more people involved in speaking, and you have the back and forth, you have action and their reactions. Here it's more or less impressionistic. It has just a snapshot, and a few of the snapshots are missing, but that one, it doesn't actually mention between verses 4 and 5 how they actually undertook to build it, does it? No. It just takes that for granted, see? And he's so interested in it that you have contrast. You have contrast between what I put here, A and A prime, and then between B, and I should put that here, pardon me, I wanted to do that, B prime, you see that? Here is where humanity is going up, and here the Lord is coming down. And then it's rather surprising how that even in these little sections, C and C prime, here humanity is coming in there, and here the Lord is coming there, and here humanity makes the decision, saying, come, let us, and here God makes the decision, come, let us, and here, this is not quite accurate, or at least not quite, I put it up here in parentheses, because it doesn't describe their actually undertaking it, you see that? But here it does describe the intervention and its results, and it's more interested in results.
Thank you.
Well, that's all right.
As you mentioned, to avoid this confusion of the previous parts of the word, we already have all these tribes and all these languages all spread about, as you discussed yesterday. This isn't in any chronological order, and it stands by itself. I take it covering a broad period of time just to emphasize the point.
Precisely. Yes, correct. None of these stories, this is a very important question you're asking. I don't think people try to do it, can be put on this sort of chronological thing, the line that it done. In a sense, what is just described last time in chapter 10, the peaceful spreading out of people, and they all has already taken place in chapter 10, if you wanted to have it chronologically. And now all of a sudden you have a different story. That means that these narratives that we have in the book of Genesis are complementary one to another. One will tell a certain aspect about basic, prototypical aspects of our life, and then another will tell the same thing. Let's give an example. In chapter 1, you have creation, seven great masterpieces. But you're not really, even though it came from chaos, and chaos is still threatening, you really don't understand creation until you also read in chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 about the flood, that God, who is the creator, can also destroy. And that then only at the end of the destruction does he say, I'm going to, with a rainbow, guarantee you seed time and harvest and heat and cold and summer and winter as long as the earth remains, you see. And so you have to take both stories. This is not setting it down logically like they would do in Christian doctrine and dogma, where you would kind of sum this up, you see. It's telling it by means of stories. Or we also saw this in the famous chapters about the Garden of Eden. You have on the one hand in chapter 2, we humans have received many gifts, we're well endowed, that make us human. You remember that? You had first life, the breath of life. Then you had a wonderful home in this world. Then you had work, the vocation, something to do with your life. Then you had the choices. You had the ability to choose. Then you had fellow creatures, and finally you had human community. It was marvelous. But that was only the positive. The negative thing is that humans always blow it. And so you had to have this. Some people have called this the ambivalent theology of Genesis 1 to 11. It gives both sides of it. You see that? Haven't we seen this throughout? Which makes it very interesting. You see that? There's a certain polarity. In the present story, you have what? Humans, on the one hand, live in unity. And we really do have the basic unity. And if we would be not so inhuman, we could understand one another. But we are so aggressive that we want to make everything totalitarian for ourselves and build it around ourselves, that the Creator then has to give us disunity. See, on the one hand, it's proper that humans should be united. You've said this, a number of you. On the other hand, it's improper that we should be united. You see that? On the one hand, it's proper to have different languages, and on the other hand, it isn't. Same thing like going back to Genesis 2 and 3. It's proper for us to have consciousness of all things like God, to know and to investigate and to really be autonomous, do what we want. At the same time, it's improper for us to simply say, this is what we began to do, make bricks in instead of stone, and now we've succeeded in making the city and the tower, and now nothing else will ever be kept from us. That is also improper. There's a certain ambiguity in the theology of this. That means, ladies and gentlemen, we could go through the other stories, and I don't want to do that because it takes too long, that you're going to have, this is not the last story. What's the last story in Genesis 1 to 11? What comes after this story?
We're scattered.
They're all scattered everywhere.
Yes, but no, I mean in verse 10 and following. A genealogy. Here we come back to the other things that are important in Genesis. And where do all these genealogies, I had put that on the board a couple days ago, where do they finally lead?
Abraham.
To Abraham. You see that? And then Abraham's going to say, in thee, and the Lord's going to say to Abraham, in thee and in thy seed all the nations will be blessed. So here you have a very interesting, I call it the tying together of the book of Genesis. In the rest of Genesis, chapters 12 to 50. That's three-fourths of Genesis. You have the story of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, isn't it? That's the big stories. And then finally from Jacob, whose name is Israel, will come the 12 tribes, and then you're in business, you see. But here you've got to get from the universal history of mankind to the specific Abraham. And so they'll have the descendants from Abram and the 10th from Shem, and really his first son born after the flood. His name is Arpaxad. And you know how many years there are in this genealogy if you count it up? Until Abram gets to the promised land at the age of 75. 365 years. We had that once before, remember that? Mm-hmm. For Enoch. 365. Not a wobbling moon calendar, but a solid sun calendar, a date, you see that? So the target date is, by the way, when Abram is there, he goes there at the age of 75. Does anybody know when the promised seed is born? Well, he gets the promise when he's 99, and he's born right on the dot of 100. You see how these things are built up schematic? And if you learn to use languages the way they did, you see, not immediately put it in our pragmatic timeline, then I think you'll understand what the story is trying to tell you. So it's actually leading it. And I might say that at the end, we don't have time to go into it, nor is that necessary. Abraham comes. That's very interesting. According to the priestly version here, into Palestine, and then he is called in Palestine at the age of 75. When he comes to what is called the belly button of the land, Shechem, the center of Palestine, and then the Lord says, this is the land, and this is the place where your descendants will be. And then it says, he built an altar, and he thanked God, you see that. Now you're in business. And especially if you're Menachem Begin or someone like that, that, for them, that is the whole center. You see that? This is part of it. And we must understand the Jews. We must understand them. We live in a little different ballgame, but at the same time, our New Testament is very much dependent upon this ancient thing. But what we've been studying so far this week has been something as pre-Abraham. You see that? Well, anything else here? Comments? Questions?
See, in the first few stories, with Adam and Eve, they were individuals that acted contrary to God. In the Cain and Abel story, it was individuals that acted contrary to God. Then this here, Tower of Babel story, it was the community.
Yes, united humanity.
And they sinned. And that's one thing we, in our day, don't pay much attention to, that we as groups sin.
Yes.
We don't really confess our group sin. By that I mean for pollution. Mm-hmm. We all pollute, but we don't take our responsibility for it.
Yeah.
In so many things.
That's a very good comment. Correct. Might say one other story that we didn't study, that would be the story about the sons of the gods and the giants in chapter 6, verse 1 to 4, is also the whole human race trying to become a super race. You see that? And it wasn't just Hitler who started that with the blue-eyed and blonde Aryans. There have been lots of attempts, and I'm quite sure there will be a human thing to go beyond, as united humanity, to go beyond our limitations there. And when we got these punishments, it isn't, as you said, just jealousy. You see that? In a sense, God does use that in the Old Testament. I am the jealous God. It means he doesn't want you to have another God. But he doesn't want you to have another God because otherwise you'll get hurt. When the first commandment says, what does the first commandment say? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. That doesn't mean that there are no other gods exist. Heavens, there are plenty of gods in heaven and earth, and they very well knew that. You see that? But for us, there shouldn't be another God. And why? Because if we have other gods, we'll get hurt. That's the idea. It's not so much as if God is envious and jealous. That's the way the serpent kind of put it, wasn't it, in the garden? And after we break God's law, of course, that's the way we think too. But really, that was a warning. Here, there's no warning beforehand. It's interesting, as you can see, I have in recent years done quite a bit of research on this. It's been interesting to me. In fact, I'm writing a book, and this may appear You never know. The book proposal has been accepted by Augsburg. I sent in two chapters, and they liked it very much. They said, when can we have the rest? And I said, when I get it done. And I hope to get it done by October 31st, which is, I have it all written. And I was able to refer to a number of those things in my studies here. I don't have it all typed. I have half of it typed. So, but
you have it typed?
Yeah, half of it is typed already. And then whether they accept it, you know, what to do with the book editors over there. Or whatever. So I can't promise you that in 2 years you'll have my book. By the way, there is an excellent, very, very, we didn't talk about commentary. Well, there are several excellent books that you might be interested in. There's an excellent commentary by one of my professors, from whom I've learned a lot, although I differ with him in many points, at Heidelberg. His name is Westermann, Klaus Westermann. And it's been translated into English and has appeared this very year in Oxford Publishing House. It's one of these joint publishing, you know, they publish part of it in Britain and they publish. If you want to go down to all, even the Hebrew and everything, it's a big, fat book, maybe about 850 pages. Although it's a very reasonably priced, I think it's maybe $35. So if you really want to go study this, you can. It's the best book out. There are two other books, a Jewish commentator, Umberto Pessuto, that has a great book. And then it's a little old, one of my other teachers in Germany, Von Rott. Gerd Von Rott has a book on Genesis that's a kind of standard. But for you, there might be two books that are available right now, which are quite good. Do any of you know the Daily Study Bible series published by the Westminster Press? It used to be Barclay. And now what they're doing is updating this. And the man is an Australian by the name of John C.L. Gibson. This is very good. Sorry that I missed up on that, and it's my fault, no one else's fault. We should have had a few copies like that in the bookstore. But it's readily available. They do have a few copies of this in the bookstore, but not just of Genesis, they have of this series. And you might find that quite helpful. And a second book is a commentary on the New English translation, the NEB. This is in Britain. It's by a Scotsman up in, I think, St. Andrews, Scotland. And it's by Davidson. It's quite good. The only thing that's a little troublesome about it is he doesn't like the NEV translation. He doesn't like the very translation that he's using, see. Translations are a little tricky, as you well know. And I still think that the one we've been using here, ISV, is, for our study purposes, quite good. I like the Good News Bible. One nice thing about my students can understand the Good News Bible much better than King James. One thing that's real interesting is that the old King James is by no means outdated, because they always translated this, every Hebrew word with an equivalent English word. And if they added anything, they were so honest, they put it in italics. and they never changed it. If they translated once one place, they always translated it in those days. That was before computers and everything else, but they did such a great job, no wonder that translation has lasted. If we were in Germany, well, of course, we have Luther's translation. And that's not out of date either. Isn't that surprising that at the time of the Reformation there was that much strength that people made translations that have lived? I'm glad that we have these new translations. And this is perhaps not as theologically deep as Gibson or as Westermann, but it's quite good. Well, I think this is a 1 or 2 minutes yet. Any other questions, comments? Otherwise, I've been very happy with this series.
I have a non-theological question. Yeah. Was there any commerce historically, is there any historic evidence, was there any commerce or communication between these ancient civilizations in this biblical area and the Chinese or the Indians? Because the Chinese must have had a civilization far advanced than these people after seeing that China exhibit in Seattle. And 6,000 years ago, they had the compass and medicine and earthquake predictions. And
I think that on the level of, say, stories of humanity, in all pre-literate societies, you often have stories of, let's say, a great catastrophe like the flood. You see that. And I don't just know, actually, I'm ignorant of a Chinese version. I know that the Hindus have a version of their Noah going to the Himalayas.
Was there any commerce between these civilizations?
Not as far as I know.
It seems somewhere they would have made, somewhere they would have touched each other in the fringes.
Well, transport was a stumbling block in those days, I think. They could only do things and talk about and write about things that they actually could see among themselves. And possibly at that time the people thought the earth was flat, too.
Well, I think that we have an answer in what we had yesterday in Chapter 10 to your question, sir, because there they kind of listed the farthermost known peoples of that time. You see that?
I guess the mountains just cut them off.
And I guess they, at least those writers did, you see that? Isolated things, I just don't know whether they would have known it. I think that one thing I thought you were going to say, this is interesting. We do know a flood story, for instance, from Mesopotamia, and they're very similar.
In Mesopotamia?
Yes. Oh, yes. And we have found archaeologically, for instance, at Megiddo, I forget which stratum, but it's kind of in the Middle Bronze Age, Late Bronze Age, actual copies of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which has the flood story, in Megiddo. So it was there in Palestine, you see that? So these things, the Babylonian Genesis and the Babylonian flood stories, were known. So in the ancient Near East, which of course is this, these things were kind of common. That's why I think it is very good that we study both of them. It was my good fortune, and I grew up in what people don't understand is a small little Wisconsin synod for various reasons, that my teacher in Genesis was a doctor from Germany, from Leipzig, and he immediately put us into all that stuff. We didn't want to learn it. We thought he was a kook. That's the only way he got by with it. But somehow or other, he made us have this. And what I was telling you the first day, that he said, well, my children understand creation. You just have to look out and see everything in creation. If you don't do that, you won't understand it. So, you know, we're all dependent upon our teachers, you see that? And no one does it independently. And so if I had made an attempt here, I think for my generation, for my students, I'll have to do that. And, for you here, and that's fine. But I think each one of us has to understand that before we were members of the New Covenant people, the Church, and that comes back to Pentecost, which doesn't violate all the languages, they're still there, aren't they? That we were humans before that. And therefore we belong to the human family before we belong to the Church. I'm not trying to put down the Church, you see that? But maybe, I've seen people, have you seen people try to solve everything through the second article, through Jesus and the Holy Spirit, and forgotten that they are creatures, first of all, and that these stories maybe should be fundamental. Remember, one of my very good students was just so great on everything, except to understand herself as a human. And that was really tough. She had to learn this the hard way, I'm sorry, but that was the way it was. You couldn't teach it otherwise. Well, have a good day.
Can I share something first? So much as a human, I've heard from you, this is the first time I've listened to you. I think maybe it's really important to always end on a note of remembering that we are never fully human until we are in Christ. And then, not until the other side of eternity, of course, when we finally do see him. But he is still, if it hadn't been for the reality of Christ, there would be no point in knowing about the
Spirit. Yes, I think in that sense, especially if I were preaching this in the pulpit or something like that, not just in the teaching. See, I'm a university professor, I can get fired.
I know.